The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2020 issue of Discover Magazine. We begin with our cover story, Growing Up Wired. Smartphones and other tech pose special challenges and opportunities for young brains. In just one generation, childhood went digital. Even before they can say the words, "Hey Siri," kids are awash in smartphones, tablets, and a torrent of interactive content. The average child younger than two spends around 40 minutes a day looking at screens, and that daily dose only increases as the years go by. One survey estimates that almost half of all American teenagers say they're online nearly constantly. The proliferation of screens and their potential impact has sparked concerns. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that kids under 18 months avoid screens altogether, apart from the occasional video chat. The group's 2016 report on media use for children cites risks ranging from poor sleep to stunted language skills. Many Silicon Valley parents, including tech titans like Mark Zuckerberg, restrict their children's screen time. But research into the consequences of screens on actual brain development is still in its infancy. Some scientists are probing how toddlers process information from video chat. Others are exploring whether smartphone use among teens is linked to mental health issues. Even video games, a childhood staple for decades, are getting a closer look. Advances in high-resolution scanning techniques now enable scientists to see how young brains have been shaped by years of playing games like Call of Duty. The goal of the various projects is to answer the same basic question. What does growing up immersed in this tech do to the most malleable minds? Maybe they're watching the latest episode of Peppa Pig on the family iPad, or shrieking with delight at the grinning face of Dad, Skyping from a conference halfway around the world. For infants and toddlers, screens can be just as attention-grabbing, if not more so, as they are for the rest of us. But some recent research suggests that the little ones might not be taking away much information from those experiences. In general, under the age of three, it's relatively more difficult for children to learn from video or from another kind of screen than it is to learn from another person, says Vanderbilt University psychologist Georgine Trosseth. The bulk of research shows that, unlike older children, infants and toddlers are less likely to learn from a screen than from a dynamic face-to-face interaction, a phenomenon known as video deficit. As early as the 1980s, researchers discovered that children learn language skills better from shows such as Sesame Street if an adult is watching them and reinforcing the material. A 2007 study, published in Media Psychology, found that toddlers struggled to learn new words simply by watching television. Some studies have suggested, though, that video chat, in which parents interact with their child in real time, is different. The American Academy of Pediatrics even lists an exception for video chat in its oft-cited recommendation that infants avoid screens. In a 2018 study, Trosseth, who specializes in early childhood development, wanted to see if receiving social cues on a screen was enough for toddlers to learn new words. The researchers looked at 176 toddlers, 23 to 32 months old, to see how they would best learn the name of a new object. They set up four different conditions: a person interacting face-to-face with the child, a live person reading from a script without responding, a recorded video of a person reading the same script, and a person interacting with the child on video chat. Then they tasked the children with learning the name of a strangely shaped object. The team found that, regardless of age group, the toddlers did not learn the object's name, dubbed Emoti for the study, in either of the video scenarios. What happened? In short, for tiny tykes still learning about the world, what is shown on a screen is not reality, and thus can't convey substantive information about that reality. If something is on a screen, it makes it harder for young children to remember what they saw, says Trosseth. In the word learning study, the flattened image of an adult on a video screen did not match the reality of the bulky, three-dimensional Emoti. Beyond that, by the time they turn two, most toddlers have seen enough implausible things on screens, Wile E. Coyote floating in midair, for example, that they've decided what is shown on screen isn't real. It's only over time, says Trosseth, that children learn that an image on a screen, like that tiny thumbnail of Uncle Joe on video chat, can represent the real world. While screens might not be ideal for learning new information, video chat apps like FaceTime may help toddlers solidify and strengthen connections with others. For some things, that responsiveness is really good, Trosseth says. And what it seems to be really good for is emotional connection. That social closeness seems to be carried by the fact that it's a back and forth. But even though screens may help children build social bonds, recent research shows that they might also pose neurobiological risks to growing brains. In November, a study of preschoolers' brains using MRI scans found that screen time changed the structure of the organ itself. Higher screen use was linked to lower amounts of white matter, the fibrous tissue that connects different parts of the brain. These connections support the development of emerging abilities like literacy and language skills. The research team notes that the findings are preliminary, with some of the biggest unanswered questions beyond the scope of the study. And the elephant in the room is looking at parent screen time, says lead author John Hutton, a pediatrician and researcher at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. That's one thing we didn't measure in the study that I wish we had, because kids that grow up with a lot of screen time tend to have parents using a lot of screens. If parents are habitually glued to screens, he continues, it might interfere with the time they're spending with their children. The point of the study is not to scare parents or make them feel guilty, says Hutton. It's to get people thinking about the idea of readiness. We make people wait to do all kinds of things. The idea that children should wait to use screens until they're developmentally ready is totally appropriate. You might not expect a 12-year-old's time playing Fortnite to improve their language skills, but a growing body of research suggests that action video games, fast-paced shoot-em-ups, might offer a variety of benefits for learning, such as improvements in depth perception, visual memory, spatial awareness, and the ability to switch between tasks. Action games are associated with improvements on a pretty broad range of perceptual and cognitive skills, says C. Sean Green, a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who specializes in cognitive neuroscience. Not all video games, or video game players for that matter, are created equal. But due to the importance of hand-eye coordination and lightning-fast reflexes in action games, they offer certain cognitive upgrades that other genres don't. In 2007, a psychological science study showed that college students who were avid action game players were much better than non-players at picking out targets such as the orientation of the letter T, even when it was flanked by distracting objects, like an upside-down T. In the same study, when players unfamiliar with action games spent a total of 30 hours playing the shooting game Unreal Tournament, those skills received similar boosts. That time spent gaming may have improved certain visual abilities for the action game newbies. Other studies point to different benefits. A 2014 study in Computers and Human Behavior suggested that action game aficionados had enhanced visual short-term memory, such as the ability to remember what color tie their coworker is wearing. In 2013, a study from the University of Padua in Italy showed that these games can even help dyslexic children read better by improving concentration and attention. While Green's research primarily involves college-aged adults, other scientists have dug into the effect of action video games on children's development. Overall, the research suggests that the benefits translate to kids. A 2010 study involving children 7 to 17 years old showed that gamers were better equipped than their peers to focus their attention on multiple objects at a time. At the same time, the amount of research on children is comparatively slim, mostly due to the genre's often mature, violent content. The benefits of strapping yourself into a first-person shooter appear to have limits, however. According to Green, only the specific skills that are challenged through the genre's frenetic gameplay, like reaction speed, are improved. And while most of the research thus far has been done in the lab, Green thinks the skills tested still apply to the real world. Such studies, says Green, are certainly not asking if you got better at playing the video game. They're asking, because you played that video game, are you now better at those other tasks? Brain scans and other ways of seeing inside the brain seem to back up these findings, too. Scientists are now able to measure structural changes in gamers' brains through imaging for their explicit content. Some studies suggest through imaging technology. Common techniques include certain types of MRIs, such as one that maps structural changes by measuring how water travels throughout the brain, and EEGs, which track electrical activity in the brain. A 2017 study using MRI scans showed more connections in the white matter of action gamers' brains. The author suggests that these connections might account for improved cognitive and motor skills among players. The potential drawbacks of video games have been the subject of vigorous debate. Many action games receive criticism for their explicit content. Some studies suggest that violent games might boost aggression and blunt empathy among players. But scientists are still continuing to unravel the mystery of how video games impact development. A 2018 Nature study on Grand Theft Auto V concluded that players experienced no negative effects after 2 months of playing the game. So far, researchers have failed to find a causal link between violent games and acts of criminal violence. By the time kids hit their teens, most have become veterans of the social media Wild West, flitting between apps like Snapchat, Instagram, and TikTok. And increasingly, even they seem aware that they're probably checking their smartphones a little too much. According to a 2018 survey by the Pew Research Center, more than half of U.S. teens between 13 and 17 worry they spend too much time on their phones. And when they don't have a smartphone in their pocket, nearly 60% of teens reported feeling either anxious, lonely, or upset. Tech companies have responded to the mounting unease, with Facebook, Google, and Apple releasing new tools to help users cut down on screen time. And a 2018 JAMA study indicated that the siren song of social media might be associated with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates ADHD affects nearly 10% of U.S. children younger than 18. It's been linked to behavioral problems, learning disorders, anxiety, and depression. According to the researchers, the more teenagers used digital devices and checked social media, the more likely they were to show ADHD symptoms, including inattention, hyperactivity, and restlessness. We can't make a strong statement about any kind of causal association, says co-author Adam Leventhal, a psychologist and professor of preventive medicine at the Keck School of Medicine of USC. There just isn't enough data yet, he adds. During adolescence, the brain is developing neural pathways that underline impulse control, attention, planning, and other high-level functions. Leventhal suggests that exposure to smartphones, where our impulses are immediately rewarded with likes and comments, could interfere with teens' ability to delay gratification, which is often associated with ADHD. There's an element of visual media where we're always on, he says, and it can interfere with the ability to maintain attention on a single task over a long period of time. For now, parents looking for clarity about tech's impact on their children may not find easy answers. Yet as scientists continue to learn new pros and cons about screen time, researchers, like Troseth, think, as with so much in life, the key lies in moderation. These technologies are not gods, she says. They're tools, and maybe that's one of the big messages. Children shouldn't be afraid of screens. They're just a thing to be kept in its place. It's not that easy being green. 9 things you think are environmentally friendly, but aren't. We all care about the environment, at least a tiny bit. Many of us recycle all we can and own a reusable tote bag or 10. Some of us might opt for organics when given the choice and take more and more rideshares instead of driving in our personal vehicles. But these things we do with the best of intentions, it turns out, can fall somewhere between not helpful and completely counterproductive. Here are some of the worst offenses and how to avoid them. 1. Recycling something just in case. Sadly, aspirational recycling is not helpful at all. Although recycling centers do have ways of sorting recyclables from non-recyclables, called residuals, you're just making more work for them. According to the National Waste and Recycling Association, contamination rates are around 25%, and then recycling centers still have to deal with your trash. Since China announced it would no longer accept imports of plastic waste, recycling programs are even more strapped than usual, forcing some cities to implement Plan B. Local and national news outlets reported in 2019 that Philadelphia had begun sending recyclables that were regularly contaminated straight to an incinerator, albeit one that generates electricity. What's recyclable also varies from place to place, so be sure you know what your town actually accepts. Not everything with a recycling symbol may be recyclable in your area. Of course, there are things that are almost never recyclable that tend to make their way into bins, too. Common culprits are disposable paper cups, like the ones you might get to go from a coffee shop. The plastic-based lining that makes them liquid-proof is too hard to separate from the paper. Other offenders are paper towels, styrofoam, glass from things like windows or mirrors, plastic bags, greasy pizza boxes, and really anything that's covered in food. When in doubt, check out your city's website. It should have a complete list of what is and isn't accepted. 2. Putting plastic bags in any single-stream recycling bin. This one deserves its own number because it's such a common practice. Cut it out. Don't put plastic bags in the recycling bin. If you put all your recyclables in a big plastic trash bag and put it in the bin, guess what? That could mean the whole thing is going to the landfill. If you must collect recyclables in a plastic bag, dump them out loose into the bin when you take them to the curb, and then toss the plastic bag in the trash where it belongs, or, you know, reuse it. Plastic bags like you get at the grocery store or big box stores are recyclable, but you have to bring them back to a designated plastic bags-only receptacle. There's often one right inside the door at grocery stores or places like Walmart. A few other bags can get recycled there too, like bread bags. But other soft, filmy plastics, like your candy wrappers, the film that you peeled off your lunch meat container, or the cellophane that held your muffin from the coffee shop, sorry to say, these are trash. Why does this matter? Because making more work for recycling centers, the soft plastics clog up the machinery. 3. Using tote bags. Sorry to break it to you. Reusable grocery bags are one of the most popular ways people try to minimize their environmental footprint when we actually remember to bring them in from our cars. Although cutting out plastic bags from your life is a good move, most people don't stop to think about the impact of the tote bag itself. In 2018, the Danish Environmental Protection Agency put together a big assessment of the environmental impacts of different types of shopping bags, from the thin plastic bags all the way up to what's considered the most eco-friendly, organic cotton totes. As it turns out, it takes exponentially more resources to make a tote bag compared with cheap polyethylene. The report analyzed how many times you would expect to use each type of bag to equal the environmental impact of a plastic one. Paper bags and plastic-based reusable totes required between 35 and 84 reuses. A cotton tote, though, had to be used 7,100 times. Organic cotton, 20,000 times. If you used your organic cotton bag twice a week for the rest of your life, it would be worth it after 192 years. Of course, if you're already stocked up on tote bags, organic cotton or otherwise, the best thing you can do is to keep using them. 4. reveling in organic cotton. Well, if an organic cotton grocery bag is 20,000 times more resource-hungry than a flimsy plastic bag, that's a pretty good hint that organic cotton is not a sustainable choice. How could this be? Conventional cotton has been genetically engineered to resist a worldwide cotton pest, bollworms. Some estimates say this biotech has increased cotton yields between 60 and 100%, but it can't be used on an organic farm. Plus, without pesticides, more of the organic crop is lost to pest damage. That means it takes a lot more organic cotton plants to make a t-shirt than it does conventional plants. That's on top of cotton already being a fairly water and chemical intensive crop. 5. Buying new, more sustainable versions of things you already have. This one is easy to get wrong, even when your heart's in the right place. Have you purchased a new tote bag, reusable water bottle, metal straw, or a coffee mug lately? What about those cute cutlery sets you can keep in your bag so you don't have to use disposable plastic utensils? If there already was a cup, bottle, utensil, or container at home or at a thrift shop, then you could have used instead of buying something new. You messed up. That's because any new product requires resources to make. Some are worse than others, sure, but anything new you buy has been made and likely shipped halfway around the world to reach you. It's reduce, reuse, recycle for a reason. First, though, use less stuff. Instead of buying a new bamboo cutlery set for your purse, just grab a fork and a spoon from your kitchen. Instead of buying new mason jars, reuse glass jars that your pickles and jam came in. And if you already have 10 water bottles, maybe don't get an 11th. Even if it is labeled eco-friendly. 6. Especially cars. If you thought a new water bottle was bad, how about that new Prius? Yes, we're happy about doubling our miles per gallon, or MPG, but replacing an okay MPG car, say one that gets 30 MPG, with a shiny new one, doesn't come without its own environmental costs. A ton, literally, of materials is required to make a new car. Don't worry, researchers at the Argonne National Laboratory crunched the numbers, and the resources required to create a hybrid car do cancel out over the long run. But whenever possible, buying used and not new will keep your impact at a minimum. 7. Taking ride shares. City dwellers are increasingly foregoing car ownership. Making the switch to walking, biking, and taking public transit is cheaper and more sustainable, and can mean you don't have to sit in rush hour traffic or circle for parking spots ever again. But as rideshares like Uber and Lyft have gained popularity, more attention is being given to the environmental blight that is cars that never stop driving. People tend to think of rideshares as almost on par with public transit, but they're not. They are worse than taking a personal vehicle because they roam around between fares. This means the total number of miles your trip takes is more than just the distance you travel. A study published in 2018 in Transportation found that in Denver, using rideshares increased the average miles driven by 84% for each trip. 8. Assuming anything vegan, organic, local, or non-GMO is environmentally innocent. Hey, almond milk drinkers, this one's for you. A lot of environmentally conscious people will gravitate towards products with some sort of green labeling, like vegan, organic, or non-GMO. But these labels don't guarantee the products are better for the environment than their conventional counterparts. We met organic cotton already, and it's lately become apparent that almond milk isn't a great choice either. Although the nuts do have a smaller carbon footprint than cow's milk, they're still super water hungry. It takes more than a gallon of water to grow one almond. Oat and soy milks use less water, but also come with higher carbon footprints. Okay, and dairy milks are still the worst. In some places, buying a local version of a product can reduce its environmental impact by reducing the number of miles it had to travel to get to you. But this concept has diminishing returns because of how super efficient it is to ship things like produce in huge batches. Worse, some people are so obsessed with buying local that indoor farming is becoming a thing. Though the idea behind local produce is to reduce the distance food has to travel, by buying local produce that's in season, businesses are cropping up that will grow produce year-round, either in heated greenhouses or, in extreme cases, indoors. They are literally replacing free sunshine and rain with electric bulbs and water hoses. Cornell University Professor Emeritus Louis Albright crunched the numbers on how impractical the practice is. He estimates that it would take about three Empire State Buildings worth of space, about 8.2 million square feet, just to grow enough wheat to meet the bread needs of New York City residents. In a separate study, Albright calculated that artificial lighting systems could add more than 17 pounds of carbon emissions per pound of grown lettuce. 9. Putting compostable or biodegradable stuff in the landfill, not the compost bin. With an upsurge of restaurants making the switch to compostable, biodegradable bowls, cups, and servingware, one might assume that these are successfully reducing waste. But sadly, most landfills are set up so that even biodegradable stuff doesn't biodegrade on any reasonable timescale. That's because most decomposition comes from bacteria and fungi that require oxygen to do their thing. Landfills are tightly packed, and once full, they're often sealed off with layers of clay and plastic to prevent liquids from seeping in or out. In anaerobic places like these, what little decomposition occurs is carried out by different organisms that create methane as a byproduct, if decomposition happens at all. That's why composting food waste is so important. The EPA estimates that most composting households send 28% less trash to the curb than their non-composting peers. And now, a few things you didn't know about trees. 1. I think that I shall never see an organism as vital as a tree. Without these woody perennial members of the plant kingdom, we might still be squirming around the seafloor. 2. About 400 million years ago, early trees transformed terrestrial environments by reducing atmospheric carbon. The result? More hospitable ecosystems for marine animals experimenting with the landlubber life. 3. Researchers described one such inviting habitat in December in Current Biology. The find, the earliest forest in the fossil record, is roughly 385 million years old. The site included primitive, fern-like cladozoilopses, as well as species once thought to have evolved millions of years later. 4. Some of these more advanced varieties also had extensive root systems, spreading out more than 30 feet across, suggesting trees got bigger earlier than previously documented. 5. Today's biggest of the big are California's towering redwoods. The tallest is about 380 feet. But don't tell Australia's Eucalyptus regnans short. Also known as the mountain ash, one specimen in 1881 measured 374 feet. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.